The Tom Woods Show, episode 1154.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as my Contra Krugman co-host Bob Murphy recently announced to the world, the Casper mattress is super comfortable and gives you a great night's sleep. Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code WOODS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Well, as you all know, Donald Trump has taken the U.S. out of the nuclear deal with Iran. And we got to talk about this, of course, and no doubt you've heard a lot of commentary about it from both sides. I'm going to be doing a little bit of devil's advocate stuff here. I've got an article that I'd like to run by our guest, Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is a historian and journalist who holds a PhD from Cornell University. He served as Saigon Bureau Chief for Dispatch News Service International from 1970 to 71. He later reported on trips to Southeast Asia for The Guardian, the Asian Wall Street Journal, and Pacific News Service. He has taught international studies at the City College of New York and American University, and he's the author of numerous books, one of which we've discussed on a previous episode, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. Today, I want to talk, obviously, about what's going on in Iran, and that means making reference to Gareth's book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Gareth, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom. Nice to be back on the show.
I was thinking of having you on anyway. In fact, I was arranging to have you on to talk about what Netanyahu had had to say about the Iranian nuclear program, and I still want to cover that. But now we have Trump withdrawing from the whole deal with Iran over this, and there's just so much to get to the bottom of here. In advance of this, I went digging around. I asked some of the people in my private Facebook group, find me the best arguments you can find against the Iran deal that I can use as a foil when talking with Gareth. So I am going to get to that.
Sure.
But let's first talk about, did Netanyahu drop on the world any information that had not previously been known? Because the headlines were all saying, we've got all these documents that Israeli intelligence happened upon that the world hasn't seen before, and it goes to show what we've been saying all along about how duplicitous the Iranians have been regarding their nuclear program. What's the real truth of the matter?
Well, to unpack the truth, I think you have to look at, not just one layer, but a series of layers here of, shall we say, not just propaganda, but disinformation from Netanyahu. And I would just begin with his completely implausible account of this supposed Israeli raid in Tehran on a location that, you know, you can see from the satellite image that he flashes on the screen has absolutely no security of any kind. So we're asked to believe a story that is just completely implausible that, in the first place, the Iranian government placed these supposed documents in a spot with no security whatsoever. And then you look at the building that they were supposedly in. It's a tin-roofed, tiny little hut with a door that someone pointed out in the photograph that's shown does not appear to have any lock of any kind. There's no security on the building itself. There was a story in the Telegraph in UK that cited Israeli sources as saying, well, the reason that they were moved by the Iranian government to this highly secret location, quote unquote, is that they were afraid that they had been in military bases, and they were afraid that the IAEA inspectors would come in and find those documents, and therefore they moved them to this highly secret location. Well, if there were such documents, these are supposedly the Manhattan Project equivalent of the Iranian nuclear weapons program that is claimed. So they would be found in the Ministry of Defense if they had existed at all, under very secure protection. So I would just point out that's a totally implausible story. And so the documents that he's talking about didn't come from that location at all. and they did not really represent what he claimed they represented. Secondly, you know, the idea that these are simply the old documents that, or it's the same content as the documents that were made public or were talked about. They were the documents themselves were never made public, but they were extensively discussed during the Bush and Obama administration, particularly the former, from 2004, 2005 to 2009, essentially. The idea that these are the same documents is correct. I mean, or the same information. It's not the same information. It's the same documents. And those documents, and here we come to a fact which I'm sorry to say, I think I'm the only one who has basically discussed in any fashion this disinformation campaign surrounding the documents. But these documents were fabrications. They are not authentic documents. I go into great detail about this in my book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And I've continued to talk about that, but thus far, no one in the news media or in the political elite has had any interest in dealing with this issue. And I can go in, I can talk about that further, but I won't get into it now. So just to put on the table here, I think that it's important to understand that these documents that Netanyahu discussed and flashed in one or two cases, you know, text or images from the documents on the screen are clearly fabrications. And I explain in detail, and I can do that with you, why we can say with confidence that they were fabricated, they're not genuine.
Well, I'm certainly going to link to your book at tomwoods.com/1154. But as long as we're on the topic, why don't you give us one or two pieces of evidence?
Yes, of course. I think the two key documents that have been most discussed from this collection, and some people may recall all the way back to 2005, 2006, the U.S. News media, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, all had stories based on their getting leaks from the Bush administration, sources within the intelligence community giving them some information about these documents, which featured two documents in particular. One was what they called the Warhead, the New York Times at least called it the Warhead Project. And it was, in fact, a set of schematic drawings, 18 different sets of schematic drawings, each of which was showing supposedly a different approach to trying to put a nuclear weapon in the reentry vehicle of Iran's Shahab 3 missile. And this was treated by the Bush administration as the smoking gun evidence that Iran did indeed have a nuclear weapons research program, and that it was really aimed at you know, making the nuclear weapon possible to be placed in a in one of its missiles that would be capable of hitting targets in the Middle East. Now, the problem with those documents, one of which, again, I just point out, was flashed on the screen. One of the schematic drawings was flashed on the screen by Netanyahu in his talk. If you look at that image, you see what I wrote about in my book, which is that the schematic drawing is of a reentry vehicle with a conical shape, a dunce cap shape. And that's a giveaway for the following reason. That what we now know, we found out after that drawing was apparently made, that Iran had in fact already discarded that design for a nose cone and had gone on to create an alternative shape for a nose cone for its longer range missile. And that nose cone had a so-called baby bottle shape. So it was very distinct, completely different from the one that you see in that in that schematic that Netanyahu showed. And that alternative, improved model of a reentry vehicle then was actually shown as part of the test of the improved missile that was carried out in August of 2004. Now, that was too late for whoever created these documents. And so I think this is a dead giveaway. I should just add one more fact that we know from both the CIA's testimony and from the best independent treatment of the Iranian ballistic missile program by someone named Michael Elliman, that the Iranians began the process of redesigning their missile, the Shahab-3 missile, and creating an improved missile as early as 2000. So this was 2 years at least before the schematic drawings that you see in Netanyahu's presentation were supposedly drawn up. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which had extensive reports on these documents. So this is the dead giveaway, that these schematic drawings were not done by someone who was really inside the Iranian missile program or knew what was happening in the missile program. It was done by an outsider who was not familiar with what was really going on and who was taken by surprise by the alternative, the improved missile, which had a completely different reentry vehicle design. I know that's very detailed, but it's necessary to really understand the nature of the evidence that this was a fabrication.
Oh, no problem at all. Because, of course, if you're making a claim like that, you would need detail. So I'm sure nobody minds. Now, I know we could continue along that line, but we really have to talk about what's just happened with Donald Trump just this week, announcing that the U.S. is backing out of that deal that I think is one of the things that Barack Obama can legitimately say he did that was a contribution to the world. And I as a Obama critic, I'm glad to give credit where it's due. I want to read to you a couple of passages from an article out of National Review for you to chew on a bit here about the deal. The first paragraph's a little bit – well, in fact, let me just read three paragraphs and then let's comment on it. So here's what they say. The Iran deal is a travesty and a boon to the regime, obviously the Iranian regime. In short, Iran entered into years-long negotiations with the West over whether it would have a nuclear program, during the course of which it developed a nuclear program. The deal allowed it to preserve a temporarily curtailed program in exchange for the shipment of $1.7 billion in cash to Iran. I'll skip ahead a bit. The economic benefits of the accord were predictably poured into Iran's expansion around the region. Rather than a new era of peace, the deal has coincided with more widespread conflict in the Middle East. Iran is now at the borders of Israel and Saudi Arabia via its own forces and proxies in Syria and Yemen. It has aided Bashar al-Assad's destruction of his own country so he can continue to rule the hollowed-out remains. It continues its attempted takeover of Iraq. It supports terror groups such as Hamas, Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Taliban. Wherever there is discord in the region, there are the Iranians fueling the conflict and supporting the nastiest actors. Let's just stop right there. How do you respond to those charges?
Do you have a few hours? I think there's an awful lot to unpack there. Let me just start with the image of Iran on the Israeli border. That border, of course, with Syria is comprised of the Golan Heights. And if you will look carefully at what the recent headlines about the Israeli bombing attacks or missile attacks, I should say, to be more precise, on targets within Syria, which involved targets where Iranian forces were located, were operating out of, what you see there is that these targets are nowhere near the Israeli border. These are very far removed from the Israeli border. They're close to Damascus. They are not within the Golan Heights area. And therefore, you know, the idea that the Israelis are merely defending their border, it just doesn't hold up. What's going on there, I think, is a part of a larger and longer term historical problem involving the Israelis and Iran, which is that the Israelis, look, I started writing about Iran-Israeli relations a long time ago, many years ago, and I've written a very long piece in an academic journal, Journal of Palestine Studies, about this, the origins and the evolution of the conflict. And you have to go back to the 1990s and the fact that the Israelis were actually threatening to bomb Iran unless the Iranians gave up their nuclear program. This started way back in the period when the Labor government was in power in Israel. And it went on from there. Actually, Netanyahu originally pulled back from that extremely aggressive Israeli policy toward Iran initially when he was elected in 1996. But then he went back and returned to the idea of threatening Iran with an attack if they did not give up their own. This is right after Israel had purchased some missiles from North Korea as a deterrent. And so you have this this relationship between an initial Israeli threat and an Iranian move to start to have a deterrent, because up to that time, they had no air force, they had no ballistic missiles, they had no deterrent against an Israeli attack. And so you have this evolution over the entire period since then of action-reaction between Israel and Iran over the question of an Iranian deterrent using ballistic missiles. But they, it took them many years to have anything like a deterrent. And in the meantime, they depended on Hezbollah's missiles in Lebanon to have the main deterrent effect on the Israelis. In other words, if the Israelis were to attack Iran, the threat was that Hezbollah could retaliate with thousands and thousands of missiles and hit a large part of Israel. And so that then meant that they had to get missiles to Hezbollah in Lebanon through Syria. And that aspect of the situation is still going on because the Iranians are still depending in part on the Hezbollah part of the deterrent. So the Israelis have been saying for a long time that they refuse to allow the Iranians to use Syria as the way of getting these missiles to Hezbollah, and so they've started attacking targets openly, declaring that they're doing so in Syria, and now they've gone on to hit Iranian targets that have nothing to do with those. So it's much more complicated. I've taken a lot of time to answer that, but that kind of rhetoric doesn't really tell us very much that helps to understand the reality, I think.
All right, more with Gareth Porter after this word from our sponsor. Folks, the headlines aren't making it any easier to sleep at night, so you need every advantage you can get. Well, the Casper mattress is cleverly designed to mimic human curves, so it provides supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. You spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you may as well be comfortable. Its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. And with over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper's becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Delivered right to your door in a small how-do-they-do-that size box. Free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada, and you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. A mattress is one of the few things you really need to splurge on, and yet with Casper's affordable prices, you don't have to. Plus, get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code WOODS at checkout. That's $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/woods and using promo code WOODS at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. All right, let's move now to the question of the nuclear program itself, because, you know, such as it is, because we now have this paragraph. It says, the Iran deal takes no account of this activity, namely the foreign policy of Iran, in exchange for what is, in the best case, a pause in the Iranian nuclear program. Since the West isn't allowed to inspect military sites, it is entirely possible that Iran is flagrantly cheating on the deal. Even if it isn't, the deal allows the Iranians to bide their time, mustering their economic strength, cementing commercial ties with Europe until restrictions on its nuclear program begin to lapse in less than a decade. Okay, what's wrong with that?
Well, to begin with, this pays no attention to the actual history of the Iranian nuclear program. And I'll try to be as succinct as I can on this, because I spent a lot of time in my book outlining the background from 19, basically right after the overthrow of the Shah, when Iran inherited his nuclear program. The Iranians didn't know what to do with it originally, and they finally decided, well, we'll keep it, but it'll be downsized, and they were going to depend on a French consortium based in France that would provide the fuel for a nuclear program, a program to heat houses in Tehran and elsewhere. And what happened was, in a nutshell, the United States, during the Reagan administration, early in the Reagan administration, decided to support the Iraqis in their war against Iran. And as part of that policy, they told Iran, you cannot have a nuclear program. You cannot have a peaceful nuclear program of any kind. Now, Iran is a very nationalistic country, as I'm sure you understand. And this was simply not something that they were going to bow down to. And so what they did was go to the black market and get the means, the technology that they needed to have their own nuclear power, to get the ability to enrich uranium. And that then, of course, was treated by the U.S. government as evidence of an Iranian intention to get nuclear weapons, even though there was absolutely no evidence to support that. And so again, I talk in my book about this process by which the U.S. national security state, the CIA, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council all climbed on board this idea that that Iran had to be suspect of having nuclear weapons ambition, even though they really didn't have any evidence of that, because it served their bureaucratic interests. And so that's a fundamental problem in the narrative that has been created, and one layer after another built on top of them, of the one below it. And then you have this campaign of falsification of documents, which in my book I explain was turned over to Western intelligence by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the former armed Iranian opposition group within Iran. They were forced out of the country. They went to Iraq. They served Saddam Hussein's purposes for years. When the Iran-Iraq war was over, they hooked up with Israel. And the Israelis used them to launder intelligence that they did not want to have be considered or to be attributed to the Israelis themselves. And I show in my book that these documents that were turned over to German intelligence by the MEK, and which the German intelligence did not trust because they knew it came from the MEK, were in fact falsified by the Israeli Foreign Intelligence Agency, Mossad. In my view, this was the most successful disinformation campaign in world political history, because it completely shifted the politics of this issue over a period of years to the point where this was accepted as fact, which was unchallengeable, that this was the evidence that Iran had a nuclear weapons program. And this, of course, was accepted by the news media, was accepted by both parties, and simply carried the day up till now, up to the present time. So I think, again, we have not had an accurate understanding of the Iranian nuclear program from the beginning. And I would just make one more point, if you give me a few more seconds.
Sure.
During the Iran-Iraq War, the Iraqis were constantly bombarding Iranian cities and military forces with chemical weapons. Roughly 110,000 Iranians were permanently stricken with chemical weapons symptoms, illness from chemical weapons, and some 20,000, if I remember correctly, were killed. As you might have expected, the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, responded to that by requesting to Ayatollah Khomeini that they have be given the power to have their own program of weapons of mass destruction. They wanted to have chemical weapons. They wanted to have a program of nuclear weapons as a response to that. And Ayatollah Khomeini said, no, we cannot have weapons of mass destruction. It is illicit in Islam. And we know that they never even had a program to produce chemical weapons. They did, in fact, set up a building, and they had the precursors. And they went back to Ayatollah Khomeini in 1988, towards the end of the war, and asked him again to change his mind because civilians were being killed with Iraqi chemical weapons. And again, he said no. And this, no one has claimed that Iran used chemical weapons in any recent years. I mean, there was during the war a claim to that effect, but it's now been discredited. And this, to my mind, is evidence that cannot be refuted, that there is indeed a strong religious rule against the possession, let alone use, of weapons of mass destruction of any kind by Iran. And again, this is something that the national security state of the United States simply does not want to seriously consider.
All right. Now, I'm just going to ask you a very broad general question, but it's the sort of question that a mainstream conservative might ask. They might say that Islamic countries feel like they are not under an obligation to be honest with non-Islamic countries, and then they'll cite theological justification that exists for this, and they'll say, therefore, how can we enter into an agreement, especially one that could have, you know, existential consequences, and really expect that it would be honestly observed? Maybe it's just impossible ever to reach an agreement with these people. It's an evil regime that there's no reason to think would be honest with us. So it's just naive to think you could enter into this kind of agreement. I mean, that's about the level that most objections to the deal are going to reach, let's say, on social media. I mean, most people don't know the ins and outs of what's called for in it, but it's just, there's no way we can trust a regime like Iran.
Well, absolutely, I understand that, Tom, and I would even go further and say that, you know, the idea that the Iranians are lying to us is a very powerful argument that goes to people's emotions, and I think it's been extremely effective, and it's far more important than the details of the JCPOA or anything like that. So I totally agree with you about this. But the point that you're making about not being able to trust an Islamic regime because they lied, that's why I cited this historical episode during the Iran-Iraq War, which has nothing to do with the Iranians' claims. It has to do with the fact that they failed over 8 years of war to respond to chemical attacks on them by Iraq with their own chemical weapons. Now, that's not because Iran was incapable of producing chemical weapons. They had an advanced chemical sector in their economy, just as advanced as that of Iraq, if not more so. And so it begs the question, or it obviously poses the question, why didn't they do so? It's not because they were incapable. It's because they had religious scruples against it. And therefore, I think that is the evidence that Iran, does not have to be relied upon. You know, their word does not have to be relied upon. It's their record that you can look to say that they are not interested in nuclear weapons. And that, on top of the evidence that I've presented in detail, that the counter evidence that has been presented, the so-called laptop documents that Netanyahu was really talking about and that were presented to the IAEA, those documents were falsified. that should be taken off the table. I'm not suggesting to you that that in any way or any way, shape, or form they are not very effective as propaganda, but they are propaganda.
What sources do you recommend people read to get, you know, non-propagandistic overviews of important questions, particularly Iran?
Well, on Iran and the issues that we're talking about, I have to say that in all modesty, I mean, I am the only journalist who has investigated the actual history of the Iran nuclear program and the interaction between Iran and the West, the United States in particular, but also Israel, over these last three or four decades. And my book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, is really the only source that goes into the kind of depth that is necessary to unpack these issues and look at them with a very unjaundiced eye. And I have to tell you that when I started covering the Iran nuclear issue back in 2006, 2007, well, actually 2005 was the first story I wrote about it, I believed, like the rest of the U.S. press, that it was true that Iran had a nuclear program. I was prepared to believe that. It made sense to me, you know, on a superficial level. After all, they felt threatened by the United States, and they knew the Israelis had a nuclear weapons program. So I did accept that. And it was only gradually, as I looked into it more deeply, and I began to see that there were some serious anomalies in the story, that it began to occur to me that the entire storyline, the entire narrative, was false. So I have to say that I do believe that this is the one source that people can look to try to get a deeper set of facts, a deeper analysis of the facts about this whole history.
Where do you write regularly? What are your outlets?
Well, you know, I used to write for Interpress Service, which was not a corporate news service. It was more like an NGO. It was sponsored by or funded by European governments in particular and by UN agencies. And it was primarily devoted to development issues. But they did support my writing about U.S. policy and national security policy. And a lot of it was about the Iran nuclear issue for a number of years. But since 2014, they dropped me. They didn't have any money to pay me anymore, so I haven't written for them. But I have written for Consortium News, which is Bob Perry's, the late Bob Perry's news service, news organization. Truth Dig, second one. Truth Out is a third one. And now I'm writing for the American Conservative, which is paleo conservative magazine.
Right. I bet in the early 70s you didn't expect that you'd ever be writing for The American Conservative, anything with that name.
I think that's fair to say, yes. That would have been something I would not have expected.
But, you know, the whole world, we just can't say we could have expected it. And I'm sure we also could have had an interesting conversation about developments in North Korea. You know, on the one hand, something good, and then on the other hand, something potentially very, very bad. So antiwar.com, I think, links to you also, I'm sure.
Yes, antiwar.com. That's right. They don't have any original pieces by me, but they republish everything that I write. That's correct.
Yeah. So antiwar.com, which I actually donate to every month, is also definitely worth checking out. And they're just always there. That's a site, by the way, that even though there's always a low-level war somewhere, I mean, my kids have not been alive for any period of time at all in which there hasn't been some kind of war going on. But they, you know, they're kind of in the background. People don't notice them that much, but it's always there. You know it's there, and then when a hot war flares up, you know immediately to go to antiwar.com. It's going to be right on top of it. So even if I don't check antiwar.com for weeks at a time, I'm just glad to know that sites like that are out there and they're doing the work.
That's absolutely right. And let me just say, one way of thinking about antiwar.com is that it's the source of record for America's wars. All the facts that one needs to have to evaluate the issues.
Exactly right. So definitely check that out. We'll link to some of these sources also at tomwoods.com/1154. You'll want to check out Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. We'll link to that there as well. And by the way, I appreciate you doing this on such short notice. I got an email from Scott Horton yesterday saying, you got to have me on to talk about the Iran deal. And then he followed up with, or Gareth Porter. And I had already written to you. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to have to say to Gareth Porter, well, you know, forget it. I got Scott Horton. I said, let's just see what happens. And I'm so glad you came through and I appreciate that. And when I think I called you, I might have called your cell phone and it was telling me that your voicemail was full. And I thought, I hope that could mean one of two things. One, he just doesn't know his thing is full and he doesn't do voicemail very much. Or number two, and here's the world I want to live in. Everybody in the world is reaching out to Gareth Porter at a time like this. And I just want that to be the truth.
Well, I wish it were the latter. It's actually more the former. But I have gotten a number of requests just in the last few days, last couple of days.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. And anybody out there, not that I want to make you crazy, but at least reach out to Gareth Porter if you've got an audience, because your audience needs to hear him. Thanks so much for your voice of sanity today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
All right, folks, I'm going to ask you a favor. Episode 1155 is going to be about some good news, and I want you to show me that you will listen to an episode about good news. And a lot of you good folks will, but when I send out an email with a happy subject line, it just doesn't get opened. And I hope the same is not true of podcast episodes, because I think we can take only so much bad news. And when something really great happens, we really ought to cheer together. And tomorrow, I will be reporting on something that is truly great. And when you see the subject line, I don't know what the title of the episode is going to be yet, but you'll know what I'm talking about. Please, please listen to it. It's wonderful. It's heartwarming. It's so important. And frankly, another thing that's important about it is something that we all need as people who are laboring in the vineyard, so to speak, of this great cause of ours. We need some kind of feedback that what we teach works and that it's still possible to make a positive difference in the world, even when it seems like everything's arrayed against you. You still can do great things. And I've got a guy coming on who's an individual who's done tremendous things, and we can all help him to do still more. So please, please do not, whatever you do, do not skip episode 1155, okay? Make sure and listen to it. And if you think it's terrible, then I owe you a Coke. But that's just impossible. You're just going to love it. And I want to be able to report on more and more good news. And we're going to start tomorrow with episode 1155, and I hope you'll tune in for that one. Oh, by the way, don't forget, you can subscribe to this show on iTunes very easily at tomwoods.com/iTunes. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.